The San Francisco Chronicle has called the American writer Barry Lopez the nation's premier nature writer. He is the author of Arctic Dreams, for which he received the National Book Award, of Wolves and Men, a National Book Award finalist for which he received the John Burroughs and Christopher Medals, and 8 works of fiction, including Light Action in the Caribbean, Field Notes, and Resistance. Mr. Lopez has also written 2 books of essays, numerous pieces of fiction, the first published in 1966, and more recently, Home Ground, Language for an American Landscape, a Reader's Dictionary of Regional Landscape Terms, which he edited with Deborah Gwartney. That volume, by the way, is published by Trinity University Press here in San Antonio. In 2001, Texas Tech University acquired Mr. Lopez's manuscripts, notebooks, field journals, and other archival materials, collecting them into the James E. Soule Family Collection in Literature, Community, and the Natural World. Since 2003, Mr. Lopez has been Texas Tech's visiting distinguished scholar, a position which brings him regularly to the Texas Tech campus. In fact, Barry Lopez has just arrived in San Antonio from a week of lectures and other activities in Lubbock. He is here in San Antonio for the San Antonio Public Library's Book Festival, taking place on Friday, April 5th, at various locations in and around the main library downtown. Barry Lopez, welcome to San Antonio, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
We often see you referred to as a writer of fiction, nonfiction, and essays, often with a focus on the relationship between the physical landscape and human culture, while also addressing issues of intimacy, ethics, and identity. That's a mouthful. How do you introduce yourself?
Well, you know, I always just leave it as being a writer. I've been doing this a long time. It's kind of staggering to me to look back on it now, actually. You know, it's about 48 years ago that my first short stories started to appear. And over all of that time, I, as you say, have written fiction and nonfiction and written in the essay form and the short story form and written books, large-scale nonfiction books like Arctic Dreams. You know, at the simplest level, I'm just someone who's deeply involved, not as a career, but as a way of life, with language and story. And I think when a reader comes to a book, he or she expects a certain kind of awareness. All of us have read books and in the middle of them thought, you know, the person who's writing this book doesn't know I'm here. In other words, the writer takes a tone of slight condescension or poses as an expert. And in the end, that doesn't always work. So what I try to do, whatever I'm writing, is be a kind of companion to the reader and use language in a way that makes it memorable or engaging or illuminating. So I think in an era before mine, it was important to distinguish the novelist from the poet and the nonfiction writer. And now we've invented all of these terms like literary nonfiction to say, I guess, that the distinguishing characteristics historically in this country of fiction, of literary fiction, can now be used to discuss certain works of nonfiction. And I would hope that that's where my work rests, that it's an effort to use language in a way that engages the reader and makes the reader feel like he or she is part of the unfolding of the story.
To a great extent, I came to your fiction last, and it took me a moment to adjust to the voice being that of a character and not the voice of the writer. I find this especially evident in the collection of short stories, Resistance. My question to you, in these instances of the character seeming to speak independent of the writer, is the voice of each of these characters, in fact, your own, or are they speaking through you?
You know, I That's a hard question for me to frame an answer to. It's easier for me in fiction to say, I'm trying to imagine the world as a writer through the eyes of these characters I create. Now, I remember some years ago, Russell Banks said to me, I wonder if people really understand these 19th century narrators that you use. And I asked him what he meant, and he said that in our time, to write in the first person is in fiction. People are often prone to think that this is the writer expounding a philosophy that he's using characters to convey. And what he thinks and what I think, I guess, that I'm doing is allowing the characters to speak from their own reality. And in a book like Resistance, all of the characters, of course, are different people, and they have, although they have a similar politics, they have wildly divergent characters, the way they've conducted their lives, what they've done with their lives, where they've lived. You know, I said to somebody once, someone said, well, what point were you trying to make with this short story? And I said, well, I've never been aware of trying to make a point in fiction. I'm trying to create a pattern that says something about our emotional and intellectual lives. If I wanted to make a point of some sort, I would write an essay. That's what's going on in that form. So the voice of me as a writer and a person is there more plainly in nonfiction and in an essay. And the voices that come up off the page in fiction are the voices of those characters. I like working in the first person because it gives me an opportunity, in the same way that the present tense does, for a greater degree of intimacy. And, you know, I know, as you say, I have encountered this before where critics or readers say, I was a little bit confused until I got oriented. I was wondering if you were actually talking about yourself in fiction or these were other characters. And I know this has happened because I've read biographies of me in one place or another that attribute to me some of the experiences, the formal education, for example, of some of my characters. So, you know, I've read that I was a graduate of Brown University, which is very flattering, but actually it wasn't.
So in other words, you find that writing fiction gives a greater range of latitude as to what opinions your characters can express?
Oh, of course. You know, I only have myself to work with in nonfiction. But in fiction, I can work with realities that are other than mine. But again, it would be important to me to say that although the kind of meta world, I guess, of the characters that I create on the page, that's a world I share with them because I don't have any way to get outside my own imagination. But they're different people from me, and some stories I've written, they are radically different, having a different sense of what is moral than I do. I think everyone who writes fiction seriously sooner or later encounters the creation of a character who's somebody you take an intense dislike to. But it's that character in a short story where you don't have that many characters, might be different in a novel, that character that you are wedded to until you complete that story, or if you feel extremely uncomfortable, you throw it away.
The story The Walls at Yogpar from Resistance is, for a variety of reasons, one of my favorites. First, when we begin reading the story, there's no gender given to the voice, and I guess I always assume it to be a male voice. Here's how you begin the story. I was a compulsive student as an undergraduate, After completing my studies in Han Chinese, I went straight to graduate school, wanting to obtain a broad-based knowledge of, if not actual fluency in, the many other languages spoken in China, a nation oceanic in its geographical and historical reach. During those years of completely devoted study, it's not until the fourth page that she refers to herself as a woman.
Being able to speak so many languages well made me, very obviously, a queer fish, even a sort of trickster figure, not to mention being Caucasian and a woman from the West. I quickly became irritable from being stared at too long and then being called after in inappropriate ways. I missed the civility of Shanghai, where I blended in better. I tried to remind myself, of course, that I had opted for the frontier, that I just needed to develop that famous second skin, a way of knowing the world that was in keeping with speaking.
Is this a difficult thing for you to do, to write with a female voice?
Well, I guess I would say that I think every male person has a greater or lesser capacity to imagine the world the way women do. Another way to say this, although it reeks of pop psychology, is there is something of a woman in each man and something of a man in each woman. Otherwise, it would be impossible to converse. The woman who is the narrator of that story is somebody, actually, I would say to you, that I sort of fell in love with, because she represents something that I admire in any person, and she just happened to be a woman doing the things that we're prone to think only a man would do. I don't think, you know, she's not a swashbuckler of any sort, but I think it's important for younger readers especially to encounter characters who are not predictable. I mean, not necessarily in their actions, that's another issue, but not predictable in terms of gender. Some things are just profoundly human, and the gender of the person is not a central issue.
Another story of extraordinary beauty is Dawn from River Notes. This also happens to be another with a female voice. You've already referred to your love of words. I'm wondering if all the right words come in a first draft, or is what we admire as your reader the result of editing and rewriting?
Oh, yeah, I rewrite a lot. The rewriting of a story, the first draft of a story for me is not, I don't tend to add events or change locales or something like that. What I try to do is to discover what it was I was really feeling and did not find the right words for. So I think it's not so much wholesale rewriting, large-scale rewriting, as a kind of endless process of looking at the music of the language and at the nouns and verbs and seeing if I can find something that works better, or I can locate, for example, an adjective that would normally not be used in the situation, but with a certain noun it creates something new. A lot of that comes as a surprise. You know, your head is so full of language as a writer. You'll see a word appear on the page and think, oh my gosh, I thought I'd forgotten that word. I haven't used it in 20 years or something. But it's the right word because you've created the environment in the rest of the sentence for that word to feel comfortable and to come up into your consciousness, into your awareness. But I work through the first draft of every story completely, probably 5 times. It's very slow work. I work at a typewriter, not at a computer. So when I finish a kind of polishing or rewriting of the first draft, and I scroll a sheet of paper into the typewriter and start again from word one, I'm introducing all of the changes that are my hand corrections of the first draft, but I'm also including things or changing things that come to mind as I go through the story. So what might technically be the second draft turns out to really be a third draft, you know. So I don't know how to count all the drafts up, but it's to say really that I do rewrite a lot, and it's just to get as many of the small things right as I can.
You just mentioned musical as something that comes into play with your writing and your careful choice of the right words. I wonder if in seeking the right word, the right cadence, the right verbal melody, if you're not writing for the ear as much as the eye.
Oh, yes. And I guess this is a very old thing about storytelling, that in addition to the words, you have the sound of the words, the music that the words create. And that can be accentuated by punctuation and the way you use punctuation to create a breathing sequence in a long sentence. I remember as a freshman in university reading a book called Sound and Sense, which was about poetry and the writing of poetry. And it had a lasting effect on me. And I think consciously and unconsciously, I utilize all of those techniques that are in that book were aimed at poets as a prose writer. And one reason I do is that the music of language makes what is being said more memorable. And what you're trying to do in writing a story, I think, is to create something that a person will remember. It's not an act of ego, but it's something else. Story, historically, I think, represents the creation of a pattern. And when that pattern comes alive in the reader, the reader often says, say, of fiction, oh, I already knew that, but I'd forgotten it. And so much of the profound effect of story is reminding the reader of what he or she means by her life or his life. The reason to make the story memorable is because that's the way the story helps the reader after the book is closed and the reader walks away. The essence of storytelling for me is to tell a story that helps. And if it is going to help in the emotional or spiritual or psychological life of the reader, it's got to be memorable, and music is part of what makes prose or poetry memorable. You can hold on to it because you are attracted to the music in it.
Apricots. It was because the water smelled like apricots, as much as anything, that she went down to the water. She rose in the darkness and dressed and went down through the trees, trailing her fingers, touching plants she knew but whose names she'd never taken to mind. Seringa, someone once said, for the mock orange, whose leaves reminded her of silk. Silk bush.
I stumbled on a cassette tape years ago in the bookshop at Big Bend National Park of your collaboration with cellist David Darling on several of the stories from River Notes. I'm always carried away by the beauty and drama, in some cases, of these stories and the collaboration, which I imagine is largely improvised. Can you give a little background on how this recording came to be made?
Paul Winter, boy, it's hard to find language to describe Paul. He's created a kind of music that brings people closer to the natural world and helps to heal that wound. And he brought a group of people together, and we all traveled down the Colorado River through Grand Canyon. And one of the people with us was a sound engineer, and he heard David playing the cello, of course, as we stopped and made music in various places. And he and I fell into conversation, and after the trip, he called me up and said, look, I really would like to get you and David in a studio together just to see what happens. So he brought David and I to his studios in Colorado, and that album that you heard was the result of that. I think the engineer, Mickey Houlihan, he heard something in the cello, and he heard something in my voice and in the way I use language, and he thought something, you know, a third thing would come out if we worked together, and I think he was right. And I have worked with other musicians and composers over the past 30 years that have emphasized for me the way in which music can carry meaning and the ways in which language can carry meaning without making sense, if you know what I mean. The music of the spoken language carries meaning even if the words don't make any sense. And I think there's a crossover here in the arts, and there always has been for me, in photography, in painting, in musical composition, in choreography, in sculpting. All of these efforts are to create a pattern that excites something in the reader, often something that triggers memories. We have this phrase we use, the work of writers and artists, but for me, artists and writers are not really separated. Writing is the most literal of the arts, and we hope that writers can be articulate about what they do, but we don't expect the painter, you know, the archetypal painter at an opening is the person who doesn't have much to say or says very little in a confused way. You know, we believe that artists don't operate with much comfort in the world of language. But the same is true of writers, and the reason many writers are inarticulate is because they're first and foremost makers of patterns, and speaking coherently, sort of getting the first draft of it right, you know, is not what they do. But I don't separate my own work from the work of friends who are painters, for example. In fact, I probably talk with, you know, in a serious vein, more artists than I do writers. Women and men of my own generation are working with a similar set of questions about the meaning of life and the direction in which humanity is headed. And if you learn to speak to each other, you can't use the jargon of your work. A painter can't use painter's jargon with a writer and expect to be understood. So you're both forced in those kinds of conversations to be extremely straightforward and plain with each other in trying to answer this question: what are we doing? What are those of us of our generation doing as writers and dramatists and actors and painters and whatever? And I have these very strong feelings about those conversations being important, because my sense is that the arts once protected us from terrifying things. I mean, it's very difficult to be a human being, a full-blown human being, and behave in the world with grace and equanimity and balance. And we're frightened by things that are, I'm not talking about global climate change, but we're frightened by the directions that our actions take us in war, for example. And is there any solution to this impulse to kill other people because they don't believe what we believe? And art intervenes there to help us make sense out of what periodically appears to be chaos. So there is a way in which the arts serve humanity and are not just entertainment. That seems to be the drift at the moment, you know, that the arts are there to entertain us. But that's not what the arts developed were, you know. That's not why human beings became dedicated artists. Even if they were driven by an individual artistic vision, there's a social impulse behind the desire to create art.
So well said, and I thank you for that. Barry, you were born in 1945, right?
I was.
So you're coming up on 70. Does it get more difficult as you get older to write?
No, I think it gets different. I this is one of those things where you don't want to look over your shoulder, you know, and see what's gaining on you because you're moving more slowly. But, most every day I'm stumbling onto something new. And, you know, last night I had some dinner with, some people, and they're working in a very dangerous environment in Chernobyl. And I thought, I'm leaving for Chernobyl in the morning with them. But, of course, I can't. I've got other things to do, and my desk is full at home. But my enthusiasm for the work has never much wavered. And I do find that as life gets, you get older, your life gets much more complicated. There are so many things come up, you know, with work that you've already done. Books are being reprinted or translated or whatever. And it's difficult to find the time to do the work that I had when I was in my 20s. And I'm not happy about that, but I love doing what I'm doing. I feel very fortunate to have been able to get to, you know, 80-some countries and travel with people and watch them do what they do, and privileged to go to libraries and read and, you know, to do things like this, to come down to San Antonio and be with people and experience another literary environment in the United States. It's something I really look forward to.
Well, Barry Lopez, we're really looking forward to having you as a guest in our city of San Antonio, and I look forward to shaking your hand. Thanks so much for giving so generously of your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, James. All right. Bye.
You can catch Barry Lopez on Friday, April 5th at 12 noon at the gallery on the first floor of the Central Library. Hope to see you there. I'm James Baker for Texas Public Radio.